This week on COVID Race and Democracy.
Don't tell us that we can't have friends that you don't like. And because the fact is, the friends that we have are people who will be opposed to murdering people in Palestine, murdering people in North St. Louis, murdering people in Afghanistan, murdering people in Syria. We will be opposed to them. And so anybody who would stand up for the liberation of those people, we're on their side.
Members of the Uhuru African People's Socialist Party speak out after the FBI raided their headquarters and homes on June 29th in St. Louis, Missouri, and St. Petersburg, Florida.
The whole reason this was brought about, the whole reason I'm allowed to run, is because of how thoroughly rotten this organization is. They made their bed, and now I'm here.
And they just voted themselves a raise through the delegates, but they're basically telling two-tier and the retirees that they don't deserve an increase. And I'm here to fix that.
Rank-and-file members push back on two-tier and concession bargaining at the United Auto Worker Convention in Detroit.
On the eve of the U.S. occupation, the first occupation, which was on July 28, 1915, Citibank went in and stole Haiti's gold reserve. Haiti is the poorest country of the Western Hemisphere. Citibank should be held accountable, and they need to give back the gold that they have stolen from Haiti.
And Haitians in New York City demand Citibank to return Haiti's stolen gold. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID Race and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Akua Holt. Chairman Omali Yeshitela of the African People's Socialist Party, founded in 1972, and members of the Uhuru movement held a press conference to speak out about what officials say a violent raid by the FBI with flash grenades, drones, battering rams, and assault rifles. Their phones and computers were seized and service was shut down approximately 5 a.m. Friday morning. Yeshitela said the raid was performed without a knock and without him seeing a search warrant. The Tampa Bay Times reports that federal law enforcement and St. Petersburg police performed searches at multiple locations, including the Uhuru House in Florida, due to an indictment against a Russian national. The indictment does not explicitly name Yeshitela or the African People's Socialist Party, but describes two co-conspirators as residents of St. Petersburg, Florida, and St. Louis. Yeshitela said he visited Russia in 2014 as part of a conference organized by a Russian organization that dealt with an anti-globalization movement in Russia, but his involvement with the country did not extend beyond that. The Russian national is charged with conspiring to have U.S. citizens act as illegal agents of the Russian government. He is not in American custody. The African People's Socialist Party was founded in 1972. Chairman Omali responded to the FBI attacks.
Some kind of controlled narrative coming out by the federal government itself, because what they have claimed is that they are indicting somebody, a Russian national, who is in Russia. And they have claimed that they were investigating the African People's Socialist Party that I lead in the Uhuru movement because of some association that we might have with the Russian government. And they have claimed that the Russian governments have been rigging elections in the United States or affecting elections in the United States, and we may have somehow been involved in that. Part of the reason they're able to make this claim with aspect of truthfulness, of factuality, is because I have visited Russia. And I have gone to Russia as part of conference that was called by a Russian organization that was the anti-globalization movement in Russia. And this movement had conferences in Russia, organizing peoples from around the world who were opposed to globalization and who were struggling for self-determination. And because the African People's Socialist Party has unabashedly been for the last 50 years, a leader in the struggle against colonialism and for self-determination, not only of black people, but of oppressed peoples around the world. I want to make it clear that one of the things that's happening is that the U.S. government is attempting to use us, the African People's Socialist Party and the Uhuru Movement, as pawns in this struggle that they're engaged in, trying to deal with the clear political and economic change that's happening in the configuration of power in the world. And they see themselves contending with Russia. Russia is a bone in their throat. This time, they haven't yet claimed us. We have some relationship with China, but that's to come, I'm sure, because China and Russia represent to them serious kinds of problems. But also, black people represent a serious problem to the United States government and has done so historically. That's why Malcolm X is dead. That's why Martin Luther King is dead. Russians didn't do that. That's why more than 28 members of the Black Panther Party in 1968 alone were murdered. The Russians didn't do that. That's why this community and our people have been under aggression. That's why a spy center is being developed right here in North St. Louis. Even as they're pushing black people out of our homes, gentrifying us and things like that, taking away our properties, created this entity that they call a land bank administration for the purpose of stealing property from black people legally. Even as they are doing that kind of thing, they're attacking those of us who are trying to defend this community and to bring economic development to this community. That's what we do. That's what we do here. That's what we've done historically. So when it comes to this issue about Russia and Ukraine, where Russia has spent, where the United States has, in this last budget offering that I saw, talked about more than $40 billion more that they've given to this entity that they call Ukraine, the entity that they put in power after overthrowing the legitimate government in Ukraine in 2014. We're supposed to have forgotten that, to put themselves closer to the border of Russia, that they have declared to be some kind of adversary, though they haven't explained to us why it's an adversary, though I don't care why they would say that. The fact is that we are able to say that we are not pacifists. We are not pacifists at all. We believe that there's a difference in just wars and unjust wars, and we are opposed to unjust wars, and we support just wars. Unjust wars are those wars that try to colonize people, keep them under tyranny, bury them under oppression, and just wars are those wars that are fought by oppressed people to liberate themselves. We don't just support Russia in this war against Ukraine. We support Palestine. Even as the U.S. government and U.S. citizens are leaving this country every day, going to Palestine, where that is murdering Palestinian Arabs on a daily basis. Don't tell us that we can't have friends that you don't like. Because the fact is, the friends that we have were people who will be opposed to murdering people in Palestine, murdering people in North St. Louis, murdering people in Afghanistan, murdering people in Syria. We would be opposed to them. And so anybody who would stand up for the liberation of those people, we're on their side. You don't have to be a Russian or anything like that. One. Secondly, yes, I have been to Russia, but I've also been to South Africa. I've been to Ghana. I've been to various other places in Africa. I've been to Nicaragua. I've been all kinds of places where oppressed people are organizing, because black people need not to be isolated. And that's what this government would do. They would have us isolated, assuming that there is nothing that we can turn to except Joe Biden, who turned loose 100,000 policemen in the street with his omnibus crime bill that's probably killed Mike Brown. And the Russians didn't kill Mike Brown, by the way. Nobody said a Russian did that. That was an American domestic soldier that they called the police that killed Mike Brown. So you want me to hate Russians? And no, I don't hate Russians, but I hate those people who killed Mike Brown, and I hate the institutions that's responsible for that. So I wanted to say that, and to be clear about that, I'm unabashedly a black man, an African that's committed to the liberation of black people, the African and all the other oppressed peoples on the planet Earth. And the United States has always historically been opposed to the liberation of oppressed people, opposed to freedom in Nicaragua, opposed to freedom in Afghanistan, opposed to freedom in South Africa. Mandela, from your perspective, at one time was a terrorist. Fidel Castro, how many times has the U.S. government tried to murder Fidel Castro? This is the reality that we are talking about, and so we are unabashedly on our own side. So I just want to say that in terms of what happened. Let me just say, they actually sent a drone into this house. They said we were not charged with anything. That's what they said. They handcuffed me and my wife out here. They wanted me to sit on the curb while they were carrying this out, something that I refused to do. They wanted my wife to sit on the curb out here that she refused to do. Only thing we do is fight for black people, black power. All you got to do is walk through North St. Louis and you can see the changes that we've brought here as a party for black people. And the government is opposed to that, and that's why we are under attack, and also because they see us as pawns that they can use in this propaganda war against Russia. That's why black people who make this mistake of assuming that what's happening in Afghanistan or what's happening in Russia and Ukraine have nothing to do with us, clearly it does have something to do with us. The United States government clearly says it has something to do with us. And what they have done also is tried to create a situation where there is the appearance that anybody, black people who are opposed, who criticize what the United States government is doing to us, must be the employ of Russia. Like somehow Russia killed Mike Brown. That somehow we needed the Russians to tell us that we were oppressed. That's a hell of a statement. It's a disgusting, slanderous statement that black people don't have enough sense to know who it is that's killing us, murdering us, and keeping us living in these conditions. And I've been to Russia, and I didn't see Russians living like black people live right here in North St. Louis. That's the reality.
That was Chairman Omali Yeshitela of the African People's Socialist Party responding to the FBI attacks against the Uhuru movement. The National Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression said, "We must always be vigilant about defending our democratic rights to organize and speak out against injustice, including communicating with activists in other countries and building international solidarity." It should also be said, this repression comes in the context of upsurge of struggle in the black community. Aretha Akili Kenyon is a Uhuru group leader in St. Petersburg, Florida. She says that the failure of the U.S. government and the U.S. imperial system is at the core of the FBI attack against this political group.
But one, I think that this exposes the crisis that U.S. imperialism is in. Because the U.S. and other world colonial powers have been collaborating against Russia for well early into the early 1900s. And this is a consequence right now in 2022 that we see the same attack against Russia. And right now, this war with Ukraine, this defensive war in Ukraine that Russia is actually waging against world colonial powers, not Ukraine as a single entity, but the U.S. and all colonial powers who have an interest and colonially dominating African people right here in this country and around the world and extracting resources from the majority of peoples on the planet. That system, this current system, is in severe crisis and they cannot rule in the same old way.
There is a long history of black leaders wrongfully attacked for unproven ties to Russia. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was harassed and suspected of being a communist and an agent. Similar allegations were leveled against Malcolm X, Langston Hughes, Paul Robeson, and the Black Panthers. Chairman Omali Yeshitela also stated at the press conference on Friday, "We've never taken money from the Russian government, but I'm not saying that because I'm morally opposed to taking money from Russians or anyone else who wants to support the struggles for black people." Yeshitela said the U.S. government was using his group as a pawn in its propaganda war against Russia. The Uhuru movement falls under the African People's Socialist Party.
Yeah. You know, sometimes I think they don't truly understand me, you know? Because they don't. Can't change the world unless we change ourselves. Die from the sicknesses if we don't seek the health. All eyes be my witness when I speak what's felt. Full house on my hands, the cards I was dealt. 3 K's, 2 A's in America. I'm just a black space born out the nebula. And everything I do or say today that's worthwhile. With assurance by your action and your first child. I begin my first now. Sometimes I speak and I feel like it ain't my words. Like I'm just a vessel channeling inside this universe. I feel my ancestors arrested inside of me. It's like they want me to shoot my chance and change the society. But how do I go about it? Tell me where I start. My destiny rerouted when I chose to follow heart. You chose to follow suit, but tell me what it do for you. Except where you down. Now you trapped inside the cubicle they built for us. The first step in the change is to take notice. Realize the real gains that they tried to show us. 300 plus years of them cold shoulders. Your 300 million of it still got no focus. Sorry, America, but I would not be your soldier. Obama just wasn't enough, I need some more closure. And Donald Trump is not equipped to take this country over. Let's face facts, cause we know what's the real motives. In the land of the free is full of freeloaders. Leave us dead in the street to be the organ donors. They disorganized, my people made us all loners. Still got the last names of our slave owners. In the land of the free is full of freeloaders. Leave us dead in the street to be the organ donors. They disorganized, my people made us all loners. Yeah, we can't change the world unless we change ourselves.
Land of the Free by Joey Bade. This is Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. Ethiopia has begun a national dialogue process intended to reconcile its 80 ethnicities and preserve the integrity of the country, Ann Garrison reports.
Ethiopia's ethnic conflict threatens the country with dissolution into smaller states like the former Yugoslavia in the 1980s. Many believe that this is what the U.S. would like to see because Ethiopia's independence and alliance with its neighbors has represented a threat to U.S. global hegemony. In December 2021, its 547-seat House of People's Representatives established the Ethiopian National Dialogue Commission and said that it aspired to pave the way for a national consensus that would preserve the country's integrity. Several thousand people were nominated to serve on the commission, and the House eventually chose 11. They chose Professor Mesfin Araya, a psychiatry professor at Addis Ababa University, to chair. Roughly 60% of Ethiopians are engaged in agriculture, mainly in subsistence and rain-fed farming and livestock production. Between 14 and 18% are nomads whose livelihood depends on herding livestock. Speaking to Oromo Broadcasting Network's Addis Asefa, Professor Mesfin said that the commission intends to involve all Ethiopians, including farmers and nomads whose cultural practices go back millennia.
A gentleman from where, suggested that the commission should focus on, say, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7 agenda. That's it. Why are they going to the ordinary people? Why are they going to the peasants, to the farmers, or to the pastoralists? The pastoralist, you know, has nothing to do, or the farmer has nothing to do with the national agenda. That's absolutely false. Because, you know, people should come up and talk, you know, their own problem, discuss their own problems, and come to the consensus. After all, it's the people, you know, who live together and have been living together for the last several millennia. So, you know, we elites came recently. You know, we are not even 50, 60 years old, but the people of Ethiopia have been there for the last several millennia. So they should decide, you know, on their own fate.
When asked how the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front, which is at war with the federal government, or any other guerrilla groups could be involved, he said that if they laid down their arms, the commission would ask the government to revoke their status as warring parties and welcome them into the national dialogue. He said the country was losing everything to the wars and that there are millions of displaced Ethiopians.
We're losing day by day. We're losing the youth. We're losing our resource. We're losing everything. And still millions of people are displaced. I know what war means. And the commissioners, you know, all the commissioners understand, you know, what war means. So what we're saying is any party, you know, who lay arm and comes to the fore and ready for discussion with its own agenda for discussion are most welcome. That's our mandate.
That was Dr. Mesfin Araya speaking to Addis Asefa of the Oromo Broadcasting Network in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. For Pacifica, I'm Ann Garrison.
A classic by Pharoah Sanders, You Got to Have Freedom. This is Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. Over 900 United Auto Worker Union delegates gathered in Detroit last week to attend the Constitutional Convention. A major theme of the convention was internal reform. The union is currently being monitored by federal authorities due to a series of corruption trials since their last convention held in 2018, where 12 UAW officials, including two past presidents of the International Executive Board, were convicted of embezzling union funds. One reform instituted under the monitor, spearheaded by the Unite All Workers for Democracy, UAWD, Reform Caucus, was the referendum where UAW members overwhelmingly voted for one member, one vote, meaning that each union member could vote directly for IEB positions, including the International Union's presidency. The key issues addressed by this caucus and other delegates was to reject tiers and stand with the fundamental labor principle of equal pay for equal work, to significantly increase the amount of weekly strike pay, which advocates payments should begin on day one of a strike. COVID Race and Democracy's reporter Thomas O'Rourke of WPFW traveled to Detroit and interviewed numerous convention delegates and guests. He spoke to LaShawn English, a UAWD member and a UAW Local 1264 president.
Today was a very interesting day today. It's all about democracy, I would say that. But I mean, I think that it shows that the administrator caucus, in my personal opinion, it shows that they want to stay in power at all costs today. It was, most of the convention been pretty friendly and, you know, it was pretty good. I mean, it was a better convention, but today it was clearly to show their power today. They wanted to let everybody know, like, we're the, you know, and they are the powerhouse. We are in their house, which it should be considered that way. Because again, when you're in a union, the rank and file is the one choose to be in a union, and we should be union all the way up. They should be respectful of each other. It shouldn't be no discrepancies because someone wants to come after you or come for a position. I'll say that, is this a position? And with those positions, it's people who think they can do a better job. But that's democracy. It's either I can or I'm not. But today, I would say more than any other time, a lot of bullying and intimidation to the membership. And that was very disrespectful, I thought. I just thought that was just not a good look for a union that's claiming that they want to change and be progressive.
You're speaking of bullying of from the podium of speakers on the floor trying to promote motions and things like that.
It was just in shambles. Like, okay, like today, this girl, Lady Dana, so you're only supposed to get two nominations. And about 500 people nominated her. So this took the process from 9 o'clock until, maybe to almost now, just to get a vote for that. And like one member stood up and says, if you guys want her, let's just put her in an acclamation. It's clearly that you want her. It's clear that you want her. This is embarrassment. But they wanted to show their power. So it was like, you know, it was like they was given a marching order last night at these regionals dinners. Like, this is what I need you to do. Because we ain't looking strong, you know, because it was a couple of things I would say that was just historic is that people brought things that were not introduced by the administrative caucus and put it on the floor. So it was noticeable that our caucus, the UAWD, which were our caucus, and other people who want reform were a lot more educated and prepared, and they were speaking properly on minutes. They was told and taught how to do the roles and, you know, things. So they realized that that was very dangerous, because when that $500 passed, that was not something they were prepared for. So there were quite a lot of things that I've seen the members do.
You started out by saying you're for democracy. But how, in specifically the UAW, is democracy problematic or in danger?
So I would say this. The membership is the rank and file. So this is the first, this is historic. So those who don't know anything about a union. So it's normally the delegates vote for the membership caucus, the administrative caucus, well, the caucus that's going to run IEB. So let me back that up. The membership would vote, the delegates are voted by the membership, and the delegates would come here and vote for the IEB. But it's really handpicked. Every pretty much it was formatted. They never get challenged. And at the end of the day, they will have a party. So this time, the membership voted for one member, one vote, because of the corruption and because of the things that they have done. And whatever reason, it's only right to be, you know, one member. Everybody should be able to vote for their leadership.
And by that, you mean everyone who's a member of a local, who is a member, a bona fide member of the UAW, no matter where they are, would be able to vote for the president of the international. That's what you're talking about. Yeah. And that does not exist until
now.
It has never existed.
Never existed until now. So for 70 years, this has been the process. And now this is the first time. So I think the problematic is that they were seeing that some of this, the rank and file that were here, because normally they controlled it so much. You know, everything they want got pushed through. Everything they want, they introduced their resolutions. It was just, everybody knows. This time they have pushed back. So I don't think they were prepared for that. But on top of that, what the problematic is that they're not in touch with the rank and file. So I do think they're gonna leave out of here and think they gave everybody here their marching order. It's gonna be different. So that's a problem. That's gonna be a problem for them.
What the 500 means and what was it before? And
it was before it was $250. I'm not sure how long it was been $250, but it's been a long time. On strike. So on the eighth day, you would get $250 from your union and just be on strike. And that, I don't know for sure how long, but it's been a long time. And $250 was not enough. And normally that wouldn't have passed. And again, with the help of the membership, with the reform members and the UAWD and other people who are reformed, they kind of forced them to raise it up to 400. So that did it without the convention. So the president of the UAW raised it up to $400, but it still was 8 days. So this time, the membership down here, the delegates, I should say, they raised it to $500, which I know they're not too happy about that. And then it also says day one, we should have to wait 8 days. Because you got to remember, most auto workers get paid every week. So they don't have a check every 2 weeks. We get a check every week. I think it's kind of for people to read from the company to get more for less, get more for less. And people are tired of it. You know, COVID showed us a lot of things. I would say that COVID shows that your employer doesn't care. You know, come in here, I don't care how sick you is. The bottom line was about getting paid. It does, you know, people want somebody to represent them. It's like, if I'm sick to the point, they say, you still have to come to work. So you didn't care about my coworkers. It was like the bottom line. So people are like, that doesn't make sense. People are allowed to work at home at the same time. You're forcing them back to work in conditions that they don't even have to use. They can be at home. I'm a vegan. I can sit at home. So I think the rank and file was like this, you know, you make a lot of money as the leadership, I should say, but you don't have to deal with the things in the plant. So I think the surge is from the membership is like, especially Starbucks and Amazon, is the treatment. Everybody want to be a union member, but they want that union to fight for them. So I think the rank and file in the auto industry and some of the UAW is that we want to organize other plants, but you're trying to organize plants, but within your own plant, you got people only making $15, $16 starting off, and you got McDonald's saying, hey, we want more than $15 an hour. So you got a person right here making $15 an hour, and this person making $30 an hour, and they're doing the same thing. And I get it, when we first did it, maybe to save the company, because we had the legacy costs, we had a lot of things. But now that's starting to build up anger to someone that's like, why should I do the same work for the same pay? And those are things they need to should have brought back to the members. Say, okay, once the company got profitable, there was no need to. So I think we want unions. We want strong unions, though.
What is the UAW's message to foreign workers who work for the same employer, who work in the same industry, whose assemblages, whose parts or fully completed cars arrive through the southern border and are sold in at car dealerships around the country. What do you have to say to Mexican workers, to Canadian workers?
So we were at Labor Notes, and I got an interesting conversation. They're willing to support us. And they even, one guy got in trouble for supporting the auto industry here. But when they asked for it back, it's not been returned, and that's bad. It's very bad. It's, you know, they didn't get no support.
That was LaShawn English, who is running for UAW Region 1 Director, speaking to Thomas O'Rourke of WPFW at the UAW Constitutional Convention in Detroit. Presidential candidates Will Lehman of UAW MAC Local 677 and Brian Keller of UAW 1248 spoke out about the corruption scandal that forced a change in the Constitution that allows rank-and-file members to run for top offices with a one-member, one-vote policy.
The whole reason this was brought about, the whole reason I'm allowed to run, is because of how thoroughly rotten this organization is. They made their bed, and now I'm here.
And they just voted themselves a raise through the delegates, but they're basically telling two-tier and the retirees that they don't deserve an increase. And I'm here to fix that.
Pacifica Steve Zelcher spoke with former retired UAW 909 president Frank Hammer about the significance of the convention.
One of the issues that exploded in the UAW is the effect of two-tier contracts, concession contracts that have led to rebellion that we haven't seen in many, many decades, really, of workers voting down contracts. When was the last time contracts have been turned down like they have recently in the UAW?
The first time that I saw a national agreement that was rejected by the membership was in, certainly in the Detroit 3, was at Chrysler in 2015. So there was already then a sense or a realization that workers deserve to get back all the concessions that they gave up in the previous decade, and certainly through the bankruptcy of GM and Chrysler, the bailout. So, and that was by virtue of social media. Social media, I think, was responsible for workers being able to communicate with each other and build their solidarity against that contract. And since then, there's been a series of contracts. And it's sort of the picture got worse and worse because the UAW returned agreements with, for example, John Deere that were rejected by an overwhelming majority of the rank and file. So it was very clear that the rank and file were not going to accept inferior concessionary contracts and had to fight with their own UAW leadership to win better agreements. And sometimes it took 2 and 3 votes before that took place.
And the profit of these companies has gone up tremendously. I mean, they're very profitable.
Indeed. And we still have workers coming in as temporary hires and part-time temporary hires. And they're coming in at rates that are now, you know, barely competitive with McDonald's.
So you're working in an auto factory and you're making similar wages as a McDonald's worker?
To it, yes, absolutely.
And this has probably created a lot of anger, frustration among these younger workers, especially.
Yeah, and there are other sectors as well that were represented at the convention. I should mention that another unique characteristic of this convention is that we had a lot of, the UAW is now one-fifth of the membership of about 400,000 are graduate student workers, teaching assistants, research fellows, and the like. And they're younger, and they're more militant, or they're more radical, and you could see the influx of that. And those graduate students are often some of the angriest because they cannot afford to live on the wages that the universities are paying, especially trying to live close to a campus. And, you know, can barely rent a space to live in.
Now, there has been a fight, a long fight to increase the strike pay. And prior to the convention, the UAW International, the Administration Caucus, agreed to a $400 increase in the strike pay. Did they think that was going to hold off any kind of revolt around that issue?
So The UAWD, Unite All Workers for Democracy, is this nascent democratic movement that's emerged in the UAW. And they put forward a number of resolutions. One of them was to not only increase the strike pay to $400 a month from $275, but also demanding that the strike pay begin on day one of a strike and not be relegated to the eighth day. So in anticipation of this coming into the convention, the President Curry announced that in advance of the convention that they were deciding unilaterally on the executive board that they would raise strike pay to $400, hoping to, you know, co-opt the movement and take the steam out of it. And actually, they didn't see what was coming. And after the convention on the first day passed, $400 strike benefits per week, first day, on the third day of the convention, we had a striking worker, I don't think affiliated with UAWD, who has been on strike since May 2nd with co-workers, UAW members at Pace, who said, "I'm really happy with starting on day one, but I think it should be $500 a week." And the convention, there was a debate, there was a vote, there was a standing vote, and it was clear that not only were the reform elements of that convention an agreement with what the brother motioned, but there were a lot of other people that might have been otherwise loyal to the IEB, to the administration caucus, that voted to endorse it and passed that that the strike funds from now on would be paid out at $500 a week.
And that must have been quite an upsetting thing for the administration caucus, that their own members were voting for this $500 a week.
So historically, the administration caucus has been very accustomed to having complete control of what goes on in the convention floor. And I'll give you an example, and then I'll come back to your question. Typically, the reform movement in past conventions, and this one as well, has always asked for a rule change. And the rule change has been, lower the threshold by which convention delegates can call out a locally sponsored resolution on the convention floor for debate. And typically the threshold has been so high, it's rarely been done. So at this convention, it didn't start out just exactly the same. Let's have a rule change. Let's take it down from 139 delegates to 45. That was defeated. And lo and behold, in the next few days, the reform elements and the sympathizers had way over 139 votes to pull out resolutions. And that was a signal that now it was the red delegates that actually had control of the agenda of what was going on in the convention floor, because they could pull out resolutions. They could tally the votes, and they had more than 139. So that literally the delegates control the agenda. And it must have been utterly frustrating for the IAB. They've not experienced that.
And when was the last time that happened at the UAW?
Steve, I don't recall that happening before. It's extremely rare. Extremely rare.
The rank and file delegates actually were taking control of the agenda of the convention. That's a big development for the UAW.
Absolutely. And the administration caucus did not know what to do. And sure enough, so the consequences were that the normal way that the convention would go is that we would have a resolutions committee, and the resolutions committee would read out to the convention the proposed omnibus resolution from the administration caucus. That did not happen, except for maybe small bites here and there. That control was gone. They could not do that. And therefore, in the place of that, were these resolutions that were coming up from the reform elements and from the local unions. They lost control. And by the time that the vote was held on Wednesday afternoon, where the delegates said, "Yeah, we want $500 for strike benefit," the IEB, the administration caucus, had lost control of the floor.
Another issue was internationalism, the whole development of Mexican workers. Why don't you talk about that, how that played into this convention?
Well, the short answer for that is it didn't. So, but in certain way, it did. So there was a push in advance of the convention to insist that the UAW invite the GM workers in Silao, Mexico, who had recently formed their own independent union. And it was very much with the AFL-CIO already having done that at their convention in June. In fact, not only had they invited them to that convention, they were actually given a human rights award. We also know that Cynthia, which is the name of the independent union that the GM workers formed, they're also invited for an August convention with the Unifor, the auto workers union in Canada, that they're going to receive a Nelson Mandela Award. So it was reasonable to expect that the UAW would follow script and would invite the Cynthia representatives to the UAW convention to address the convention to talk about not only their victory in Mexico, but also the fact that the Cynthia members, the GM Silao workers, had expressed solidarity and been in solidarity with the UAW GM strike in 2019 at GM. None of that happened. The UAW did have guests from Mexico. They were all members of the Solidarity Center, staff members, in Max Station in Mexico. Not the workers, not the GM workers that had scored this unbelievable, unprecedented victory. Now, the way that information did get to the floor was through UAWD that were highly organized, were issuing newsletters each day, summing up some of the things that had gone on the previous day, putting forward an agenda for that day, and they publicized the heroic struggle of the GM Silao workers and the fact that they formed a union. And the suspicion is that the UAW did not want to have these Mexican GM workers addressing the convention because they had just waged a fight against a corrupt union at their location. And they did not want any connection between these valiant Mexican workers who fought against a corrupt union with any of the elements at the convention who were fighting the same.
That was retired United Auto Workers 909 President Frank Hammer speaking to Steve Zeltzer about McDonald's wages in auto and the refusal to invite Mexican GM Silao workers to the convention by the UAW International.
United, we're as strong as a mountain. United, we're as deep as the sea. Stand together, shoulder to shoulder, sisters and brothers, united and free. It seemed to be the right time, the right place, a love of country to the fore. Smiles on eager faces, a nation's heart beating heard once more. Those in power knew just what they wanted. Divide and rule was their cry. When the votes were cast and counted, the hopes of thousands by lies. United, we're as strong as a mountain. United, we're as deep as the sea. Stand together, shoulder to shoulder, sisters and brothers, united.
Stand Together by CeeLo Bay. This is Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. Last Thursday, July 28, the Haitian group in New York, Comacota, protested in front of the headquarters of Citibank in Manhattan, demanding that Citibank return Haiti's stolen gold. In 1914, the U.S. military invaded and occupied the independent country, as reported by the commander of the U.S. Marine Corps, General Smedley Butler. Thousands of Haitians were killed. The U.S. Marines did not leave until 1934. On the eve of the U.S. invasion and occupation of Haiti, U.S. Marines walked into the National Bank of Haiti and stole Haiti's gold reserves and carried them to the coffers of First National City Bank, now at 55 Wall Street in Manhattan. Haiti's gold has never been returned. Citibank is currently worth about $327 billion. Mitchell Cohen of Pacifica Radio WBAI New York City was there and brought us this report.
In 1914, the U.S. military invaded and occupied the independent country, Haiti, as reported by the commander of the U.S. Marine Corps, General Smedley Butler. Thousands of Haitians were killed. The U.S. Marines did not leave until 1934. General Smedley Butler said of this and other U.S. imperial ventures, "I helped make Mexico, especially Tampico, safe for American oil interests in 1914. I helped make Haiti and Cuba a decent place for the National Citibank boys to collect revenues in. I helped in the raping of a half a dozen Central American republics for the benefits of Wall Street. The record of racketeering is long. I helped purify Nicaragua for the international banking house of Brown Brothers in 1909 through 1912. I brought light to the Dominican Republic for American sugar interests in 1916. In China, I helped to see to it that Standard Oil went its way unmolested. During those years, I had, as the boys in the back room would say, a swell racket. Looking back on it, I feel that I could have given Al Capone a few hints. The best he could do was to operate his racket in three districts. I operated on three continents." On the eve of the U.S. invasion and occupation of Haiti, U.S. Marines walked into the National Bank of Haiti and stole Haiti's gold reserves and carried them to the office of First National Citibank. Haiti's gold has never been returned. Citibank is currently worth about $327 billion. Last Thursday, July 28, the Haitian group in New York, Kamakota, protested in front of the headquarters of Citibank in Manhattan, demanding that they finally return Haiti's gold. I was there and recorded this interview with Fabian, one of the organizers of the protest.
I'm part of a group called Kamakota, and today we are here specifically to denounce Citibank's and the theft of Haiti's gold on the eve of the U.S. occupation, the first occupation, which was on July 28, 1915. Citibank went in and stole Haiti's gold reserve. Haiti is the poorest country of the Western Hemisphere. Citibank should be held accountable, and they need to give back the gold that they have stolen from Haiti. And it's a continuing pillage of Haiti. The Clinton are famous for stealing billions from the earthquake when goodwill people gave in their $5, their $2, their $20 to help Haiti recover, and that money was not used to build one house. So the Clintons are definitely part of that legacy to continue to ruin Haiti. Citibank, the Clintons, and many others are continuing.
A lot of the materials put together and assembled in Haiti in sweatshop zones.
And that's another issue that Kamakota has been very active about, trying to support the people on the ground, the factory workers in Haiti. They are getting paid less than $5 a day. I believe maybe $3. That's what they're getting. A lot of people are making money off poor people's labor and strength and courage. And that is all the factories that are in Haiti are implicated, whether it's the Gap, whether it's Old Navy, I could cite a few more. But there's a whole consensus that Haiti, again, is not the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, hazardly. This is by design. And a lot of people have their hands in it. We need to hold them accountable. And that's what we try to do. And hopefully we will have a mass movement, a popular movement, because it's not just Haitian laborers, it's laborers all over the world that are being exploited by the, you know, big corporations and by the big government. To be human and to be part of a, you know, humane society, we cannot have anyone in shackles. Everyone has to be free. If you want to look at an example of what humanity is, then look towards the Haitian Revolution. I'm Fabienne. I was born in Haiti, but I'm a Brooklynite since the past 32 years.
This is Daoud André, member of Kamakota. committee to mobilize against dictatorship in Haiti, and the host of Haiti, Our Revolution Continues, which airs on Saturdays 4 to 5 on BAI. The Clintons, both Bill and Hillary Clinton, after the earthquake, they went and found Michel Martelly, someone who would do their bidding, and they placed him as president of the country, not just to cover up for the monies they stole, more than $6 billion, because they stole this out of the CIRH, the Haiti Interim Recovery Commission. Then you had the Clinton Foundation that was running its money scam. You had the State Department that Hillary was running all USAID money scams in Haiti. And you had this thing Obama created called the Clinton-Bush Fund. So four sources of money that the Clintons were milking in Haiti. In the middle of this, have this guy running the country. And they had just announced that they found something like $20 billion worth of gold in the northeast of Haiti. But when they tell you $20 billion, it might be $200. Two companies that Michel Martelly gave mining contracts for this gold in the northeast of Haiti, and one of them is VCS Mining that had Anthony Rodham, Hillary's brother, on the board of it. We understand that although the Senate in Haiti had blocked gold mining, they continue to take stuff out of the country. The U.S. occupation that started on this day, July 28, 1915, it continues because the U.S. never stopped their domination, I don't know how else to call it, their pillage, their plunder of Haiti, installing governments that they want, toppling governments that they don't agree with, that is not willing to do their bidding. The people of Haiti, we know the harm that the Clintons have done, and we will do whatever we have to do to fight the Clintons. At the last debate, when Trump asked her what happened to Haiti's money, and she said everything she did in Haiti was in the best interest of the United States. And we understand that. Take note, in the year and a half that Biden has been there, he's deported more people to Haiti than the past three presidents in the United States, including Donald Trump. Maybe 35,000 people that he's deported to Haiti alone since he's come into power. Joe Biden has already put out more people than the deporter-in-chief.
Mitchell Cohen, WBAI Pacifica Radio, New York.
In closing, pioneering actress Nicole Nichols, who starred as the communications chief Uhura in the original Star Trek franchise in the 1960s, made her transition on July 30th in Silver City, New Mexico. According to her son, Kyle Johnson's post on social media, she was 89. Ms. Nichols selected the name Uhura, a feminized version of the Swahili word for freedom. Her memoir, Beyond Uhuru, Star Trek and Other Memories, was published in 1994. And that concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the executive producers of CRD, Akul Holt, Paulina Fazilia, and Steve Zeltzer. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on Twitter at PacificaCRD and on Facebook at COVID, Race, and Democracy. I've been your host, Akul Holt. Thanks for listening.